Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Center for the Study of Europe at Boston University. It's titled The Famine Plot, England's Role in Ireland's Greatest Tragedy. Our speaker is Irish historical writer Tim Pat Coogan. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler.
Timothy Pat Coogan is an Irish historian, broadcaster, and newspaper columnist. He served as editor of the Irish Press newspaper from 1968 to 1987. The titles of his books tell a history in themselves. The Easter Rising, Michael Collins, The Man Who Made Ireland, The IRA, On the Blanket, The Inside Story of the IRA Prisoners' Dirty Protest, Ireland in the 20th Century, and Wherever Green is Worn, The Story of the Irish Diaspora, among others. Clearly, Coogan does not shy away from controversy. His work has shaped perceptions on Ireland for millions of Irish Americans for decades now. His views are strong, staunch, and immensely profitable for us as we try to piece the history of modern Ireland together. One definition of the word history, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, which has 10 definitions, is a narration of events, especially professedly true ones. History is, after all, a story, a narrative, and Coogan has the gift of a master storyteller. His is at once an art and a documentation. If, as Adorno has it, art is the sedimented history of human misery, what of history itself? And here I am reminded of some words from the poet Paul Muldoon, who read last week at BU. History's a twisted root, with art its small translucent fruit, and never the other way round. I welcome Tim Pat Coogan.
Well, I don't know whether I come to you as a small fruit or a twisted root, but I'm here anyway, to talk about the Great Famine, which was simply the most important event in Irish history. It was inevitable that it would arouse strong reactions as to why it was occurred and what could have been done to avert it or ameliorate the conditions. But it's quite extraordinary that an event which took nearly a third of the population and has had a profound effect on world history. I'm quite certain some of your ancestors came here, and that's why you're here now. A president of the United States, prime ministers of Australia, everywhere in the world was affected by the emigration of the famine. And Ireland itself was struck a really powerful blow that still has resonances psychologically and economically. When you hear about famines today, you're hearing about famines, say, in Darfur, where about 250,000 died. Horrible as it was, but it was out of a population of some 19 million. So if it were to happen in Ireland, which was tending towards 9 million, you can see that it really affected the country most profoundly. And any efforts to say otherwise, or that it didn't affect, say, Dublin, are just wrong. It affected every fibre of the country's being. And as a result, it was so cataclysmic, and there were effects both in Ireland and in England which made people keep their head under the parapet when it came to talking about it. In Ireland, the uncomfortable fact is that a lot of people today are living on land that was acquired by their forebears through the famine. When people were evicted, it was or managed some way to outmaneuver the sitting tenant. The land was taken by people whose children would have gone to school with the other's children who would have lived side by side. Or, as they say, took the soup, because one of the features of it was an effort to proselytize the people with the Protestant religion. If they got soup and nourishment, they went to Bible classes, and they then turned their religion and became Protestants. And you can imagine that that left a resonance. But above all, there seemed to be an effort, particularly amongst academic historians, not to touch the subject, or if they did it, to sanitize it. There was a tradition in Irish studies. It was accentuated by the war in the north. And a famous historian, he was a Marist monk, and he was also the master of Peterhouse College in Cambridge. And he wrote a famous pamphlet which really accounted for the revisionists. Revisionist historians stopped being heard from after his pamphlet. And he pointed out that there was a concerted effort being made to sanitize Irish history, to filter out the trauma, partly to avoid giving ideological hinterland to the Provisional IRA for their struggle, and partially not to offend the British. The doyen, I would think, you would find general acceptance for that term, the doyen of modern Irish academic historians is Joseph Lee, formerly of Cork University, and he's now teaching in New York. And he said that it had to be borne in mind that historians of a certain era, which means practically up to now, all got their degrees from English extern examiners. And they were very conscious, as he put it, one of the reasons he is the doyen, he uses language very carefully, he said that they were very careful not to be accused, to restrain exuberance, lest they be accused of Celtic flights of fantasy, and therefore they decided to err on the side of sobriety, which really means to put out the accepted gospel. In other words, Irish history really was taught with a certain colonial cringe. And you would find quite good history done, but they would shrink from the conclusions. They'd give all the facts, but when it came to the issue of culpability, this would be kind of airbrushed out of the narrative. Now, briefly, the famine itself began, the famine we're talking about. In fact, Ireland was so badly misgoverned that there have been several famines in Ireland within a century before it. In fact, if you go to Ireland, those of you who have done, you're probably aware of Dublin Bay where you come in. You can see the hills around it. And you'll see at a place called Killiney, you'll see an obelisk on the top of the mountain, the hill, not a mountain. And that is a famine relief work put up by a landowner during a famine, 10 famines back from what we call the Great Famine. So you can see hunger was no stranger to Ireland. The population had been decimated the previous century. And when we come to 1845, you come to a country without a government of its own. The Act of Union of 1800 had suppressed the Irish Parliament. And with that and the departure of the parliamentarians to, there was subsumed into the House of Commons, where they were completely outvoted. There were 105 or 6 Irish deputies, we'd call them, or MPs, members of Parliament. And they were completely outvoted by a total of some 600. Anyway, the 100 were not all representative of the Catholic class, the Cottier class. They're representative of big landowners and so on. And Daniel O'Connell, the great Daniel O'Connell, it was incredible how he used about 30 or 40 of those to actually get Catholic emancipation in 1829. But the departure of the so many people, not alone politicians went, poets went, plumbers went, plasterer went, the artisan, doctors, lawyers. That's where the money was, London. And particularly the landowners. It was a great deal of what was known as absentee landlords, absenteeism. They got the rents, and they were just like people owning shares in a mine in South America. As far as their interest in the land or improving it, forget about it. There were some good landlords living in Ireland. Generally, you would find the good landlords amongst the ranks of those who lived in the country. But it consolidated the trend towards middlemen taking large tracts of land from the landowner and then parceling it out, increasing rents, small parcels to small farmers, smallholders, cottiers. And finally, such a shambles was arrived at that by the time the famine struck, or the blight of the potatoes struck in 1845, there were 3 million people, 3 million out of a population of 9, living in these completely uneconomic little holdings and living in incredibly bad, wretched conditions, mud cabins, no windows, a door, no back door. The smoke would go out not through a chimney but a hole in the roof, because it was par for the course. If you improved the holding, the rent went up, so you didn't improve the holdings. Now, what would have been needed, obviously, would have been a long-term, sustained, humane and efficient assisted emigration program to get those people off the land and cease having them living on potatoes, getting married very young, and propagating. But that didn't happen. And the blight struck first in 1845, in August. Now, there's different theories as to where it came from. Currently, the Irish Agricultural Institute has done studies, and it seems to point towards guano, bird droppings, which came in various cargoes, Mexico, Peru, and other places. And it fetched up in other parts of Europe, but, of course, it had a devastating effect in Ireland when it showed up, and there was panic in the country because everybody realised that 3 million of them, of the people, lived on nothing but the potato. And at the time, initially, Ireland was fortunate because while he didn't like the Irish, the Conservative Prime Minister, Robert Peel, was the most able man. He founded the police forces, which eventually became Scotland Yard in England, for example, the Royal Irish Constabulary in Ireland eventually. He had been Chief Secretary of Ireland. He favoured the Orange, the Protestant element. And in fact, Daniel O'Connell used to refer to him as Orange Peel. And he didn't, as I say, really like the Irish, but he knew what had to be done. And he immediately, sub rosa, he began arranging shipments to the banking firm of the Baring brothers of shipments of grain into Ireland, Indian corn, which had all kinds of awful side effects because it was flint hard and it wasn't properly prepared, and what it did to the digestive systems is far better imagined than described. In fact, it was known as Peel's brimstone. But at least by releasing it from at strategic moments on the market, he kept the price within the range of the poor. And actually, nobody died under Peel. Even though there was failure of the potato crop, nobody died under the Conservatives. But then, with great courage, he decided that he'd have to tackle the corn laws, which was the reason he'd had to bring the shipments in sub rosa in the first place. The corn laws prohibited the importation of cheap outside grain, say from India or wherever, because the squirearchy who controlled the Conservative Party and much of English political opinion, much of the money, they were averse to cheap imports. And Peel, not only for Ireland, but for the now growing Victorian cities, industrialisation was going apace, and there were hordes of people pouring into these cities. So cheap flour, cheap bread was an essential. So he took on the lobby and defeated them in what was apparently, to this day, the most bitter and vicious and acrimonious debate in English parliamentary history. But he eventually won. But in so doing, and he didn't win it like that tomorrow you can bring in free corn. It took two or three years for the thing to be implemented, by which time the famine was roaring through Ireland. And he fell from power over that because they laid a parliamentary ambush for him. Both the Whig Party, the Liberal Party, as they've been known as, and the Conservatives coalesced over an Irish measure. Show you how bad things were in Ireland. I think it was the 17th coercion law introduced from the time of the Act of Union to that day in 1846, in July of 1846. And the division bells were tolling in the upper house, in the House of Lords, passing through the Corn Laws just as they laid this ambush and defeated him. Now, he didn't have to resign, probably because he was stressed out over what he'd gone through. Who knows, really? He resigned. And the Whigs arrived in. And in particular, this meant that one civil servant, Charles Trevelyan, from a Cornish family, he disliked the Celts, and he said that he had his family had acquired habits of industry and general civilized habits and dispensed with the Celtic disabilities through long association with the Anglo-Saxons. So that gives you an idea of how he felt about Celts and about the Irish. And we have, and here is something I just don't understand. We have a document that academic historians have overlooked up to now. He did something extraordinary. He came back from Ireland, where he had spent 6 weeks, as he said himself, doing nothing but thinking Ireland, writing Ireland, talking Ireland. And he briefed Peel privately about what he'd found. Two of his findings, for example, were that there was about to be a massacre of Protestants arising on the scale of the Bartholomew Day massacre. Another was that one of the worst things Daniel O'Connell was doing at the time, he was having his monster meetings trying to get repeal of the Union, of the Act of Union. And he said that one of his worst crimes was putting into people's head the absurd idea that there was such a thing as an Irish nation. There was no Irish nation in his view. Another factor which hasn't been properly adverted to was the presence at the cabinet table of four of the greatest Irish landowners, in fact, the four biggest. There was Lord Lansdowne, and they said of him that if you walked on his land from Dublin, you could get to Kerry in the southwest, still walking on his land. Now, that's an exaggeration, but he did have of the order of 100,000 acres and more. There was also a couple of other people in the west who had huge estates. One of them was a fairly humane man, and were indebted to him for his correspondence with Trevelyan and others. Monteagle was his name. We know that what he'd take alarm, take fright at some of what was being proposed, but to no avail. But it gives us an insight today into another version. But above all, there was Lord Palmerston. Now, Palmerston was the architect of gunboat diplomacy. He was the man that had a special warship built with engine and sail power and huge firepower, which destroyed the Chinese junks and was able to go up the great rivers. And he used that to impose the opium trade, which the British wanted, on the Chinese people, the drug trade. It would be as if somebody came and imposed the drug trade on America after America had somehow managed to get rid of it. He also got the Hong Kong island, which they gave back some years ago to the Chinese. So you can imagine his feelings for his Irish tenants. It wasn't too deep-rooted. And there was also a Lord Clanricarde, who was not friendly, to put the least of it, to the tenants. And when these men resorted to emigration as their panacea for what was happening, they were not tender about the way they sent their tenants off. But by March of 1847, it was obvious the famine was raging in Ireland. And some people want something done. There was some discussion about the humanitarian aspect. One result of the Corn Law debate was that Lord Russell, the Prime Minister, who sounded very sharp, and when he was speaking, for example, when he began as Prime Minister, the speech he gave on Irish relief marked a very sharp change with what had been done under Peel. And he said it had been a great waste of money, that would have to stop, and that it'd have to be, in effect, means test, it would all have to be limited. And generally, the Whig virtues of sobriety, hard work, and temperance, etc., self-reliance would have to be followed. And the general opinion amongst the ranks of the Whigs was that the potato was, and the way the Irish lived was the cause of all this problem. And he was actually quite ineffectual, though, in cabinet. He was the son of a duke and huge holdings and so forth. But when he married a widow, he was a very small man. You can imagine the opinion his colleagues have, because his nickname was the widow's mite. And that would about summarize the kind of influence he had. I mean, the lack of Palmerston and so on just disregarded him. Now, they had a system of welfare in Ireland. It was based on the British Poor Law system. It had been introduced back in 1838. It wasn't suitable to Irish conditions. It involved setting up workhouses. There was about 130 of them, and they were to be sustained. The country was divided up into unions, as they were called. And within the unions, money was to be raised to pay for the workhouse and to pay for the cost of running it and for the people therein. Now, in the best of times, that system was devised to cope with some 1% of the population. Of the 3 million, for example, living in poverty, that would account for some 30,000 only. So it was grossly inadequate, and it led to terrible problems. And then, as the various debates roared on about whether or not there should be help for the Irish, other factors came into play. For example, there had been great discussion prior to the famine and with the introduction of workhouses, both in first in England, then in Ireland. Well, England had a kind of a social welfare system back to the days of the Tudors, but Ireland didn't. It's private charity or the churches. And all kinds of people had their say. Political economists that you'd all have heard about, Jeremy Bentham, Malthus, Adam Smith was constantly cited. And the all of this distilled into the dogma, as far as the Irish are concerned, of poverty being largely your own fault, and nobody owed you anything, and laissez-faire, which meant no, let the market decide, no interference with the market. And those kind of themes were struck publicly by Russell when he took over in 1946, but more importantly, a gesture, if you like, by Trevelyan shows you what it meant in practice. One of his first, possibly on the very first day he came in, certainly not long after, he wrote to the Barings cancelling this system and sending in the ships of food. And in fact, one was turned back as it was sailing towards Ireland. And Barings said to him, "Well, I'm delighted to hear your feeding operations have worked." But of course, they hadn't worked. And by March of 1847, it was evident that there was a first-class debacle, you know, a human tragedy of unimaginable proportions looming. And this was discussed at the Cabinet on a day in March of 1847. And this is what Palmerston had to say in a document, a memo he circulated to his colleagues. He said, "It was useless to disguise the truth that any great improvement in the social system of Ireland must be founded upon an extensive change in the present state of agrarian occupation, and that this change necessarily implies a long, continued and systematic ejectment of smallholders and of squatting cottiers. Now, ejectment was carried, that was in fact the de facto policy that was adopted. The de jure policy seemed to be based on using the workhouses, outdoor relief based on roadworks, which were useless actually. They dug up roads and replaced them. They built roads going nowhere because laissez-faire, you couldn't interfere with the market. And Trevelyan, who had more and more ascendancy over Sir Charles Woods, wouldn't allow him to, or wouldn't allow anybody. There was Sir William Bentinck proposed that they introduce railways, a railway building program to Ireland. And Trevelyan came up with the answer to that was you couldn't have that because railway builders needed very skillful people and so on, and there wouldn't be enough employment given, and Ireland wouldn't be suitable for that. So how that argument gels with the construction of the great railways across America, Pacific Railway, others, I don't know. But the Irish built them and the canals and so forth. It would have been quite a good thing to do. But they had this Janus phase policy of, on the one hand, which was adopted, the systematic ejectment. They were falling into arrears of rent all the time, of course, because with no potatoes to eat or to sell, how could rent be paid? And the situation in the country got progressively unbelievable and horrific, but it was worsened by things like they made relief contingent on a really stringent test of pauperism. For example, anybody who owned any more than a quarter acre of land, a quarter of an acre, had to give it up before they could get relief. So that really left the peasants and the cottiers at the mercy of the system. And the men on the ground, particularly, he wasn't a particularly kind-hearted man, but he was there and he didn't like seeing what he was seeing, and he was responsible for Ireland, was Lord Clarendon, who was the chief secretary. Ireland was governed from Dublin Castle, and there was what looked like a panoply of power and so on, but it was administered, really. The big decisions were taken, the money decisions, in London. And Clarendon wrote once to Russell, this would be typical of the sort of letter that they were supposed to get the money to pay for the unions from the local people, the rates, whatever, taxes. But where was the money to come from? The worst poverty was where all these people were clustered, all these millions in mud cabins. And Clarendon, talking about the peasantry, wrote to Russell, to his prime minister, and he said, "There are whole districts in Mayo and Donegal and parts of Kerry where the people swarm and are even now starving, and where there is no landed proprietor to levy on, he is absent or in chancery, bankrupt, and the estate subdivided into infinitely small lots. What is to be done with these hordes? Improve them off the face of the earth, you will say, and let them die. But there is a certain amount of responsibility attaching to it." So you can see what even a powerful official like Lord Clarendon was getting when he wrote to his prime minister. He was getting nowhere, being told, in effect, to let them die. And that was, in fact, what the policy was. Because it became apparent to Clarendon that the policy was one which Trevelyan had developed, and which he termed natural causes. Natural causes. The thing was to be left to natural causes to solve. And natural causes also, of course, meant emigration. And again, because of their habit of writing to each other, we know what the official policy was. Sir Charles Woods wrote to Monteagle, a fairly humanitarian landlord at the cabinet table, who was complaining that as the famine was gathering force, emigration was setting in. By 1848, there was a flood of people out of the country. They were so desperate to get out that people committed small crimes to get transported. They'd rather risk going under armed guard in a prison ship to Australia than stay there and starve. But when Monteagle wrote to the Chancellor, pointing out that even on economic grounds, this was crazy, because he was losing really good farmers off his estates, men with 40 or 50 acres. Disaster and ruin lay ahead. And Woods wrote back, he said, "I'm not at all appalled at your tenants going. It seems to me to be a necessary part of the process." And the process was the part that was signaled by the reading of the memorandum to the cabinet by Palmerston, the ejectment of smallholders and cottiers. But that was made even more explicit by Trevelyan. Trevelyan is on record as saying, "I do not know how farms are to be consolidated if small farmers do not emigrate. By acting for the purpose of keeping them on the land, keeping them at home, it would be defeating our own object. We must not complain if what we really want is happening." What we really want. And, of course, to defeat their object, what he meant there was to give them adequate humanitarian aid. Now, the workhouses, of course, as I said earlier, were only able to hold 1% of the 3 million, if that. And famine fever, the absence of basic vitamins like vitamin C, all sorts of fevers took hold. And the generic term famine fever would take in a whole lot of things: typhus, cholera, pellagra, the bloody flux, as they called it, a form of bacillary dysentery. Now, I don't want to nauseate you, but the condition of the workhouses, I just read one paragraph from a doctor, or what the onset of some of these diseases meant in the cabin home. But of course, you can imagine the effect of infection from a scene like this. The dysentery struck suddenly, and within a few hours, the patient would have 12 or 20 evacuations consisting of a serious bloody fluid, often without a trace of mucus or fecal matter. The dysentery was accompanied by an offensive odour, characterised by another doctor as being similar to that of putrid flesh in harsh weather. And you can imagine, now, men, women and children were segregated in these workhouses, but the overcrowding was absolutely appalling. If you were to go to Skibbereen today, you may or may not have heard the ballad "Revenge for Skibbereen." It was one of the most widely, I think it was the most widely sung ballad amongst the Irish emigrants worldwide, and indeed at home. I heard it sung many a time. My mother sang it. But now that's been superseded by, curiously, it's coming up, and it's been sung at football matches all over the world where the Irish play both soccer and rugby. And it's "The Fields of Athenry," about a lad who's been transported because he stole Trevelyan's corn, and a prison ship lies waiting in the bay. It's his wife who is singing. It's amazing how the famine resonance, its hour seems to have struck again, and people are talking about it and thinking about it. Because in places like Skibbereen, the overcrowding was such that if you were to go there today, there's a famine heritage centre, and you'll find I think is the most striking exhibit anyhow. There's a 22-inch tile, just a 22-inch tile, and that's the exact amount of space available to everybody in that workhouse. And it would have been much the same elsewhere. Here, for example, now is a description by a doctor in Trim Workhouse, where the children were affected in particular. And also Cork, the same thing, for example. He found that 150 boys were forced to occupy a ward 45 feet long by 30 feet wide. They had 24 beds between them. The inspecting doctor found that the children were, quote, unhealthy and drooping, and that the smell of the sewage was so revolting and so disgusting that I will not here enter upon it. And some 60 children had died in the previous weeks there. And in other workhouses, recorded by the visiting doctors, that the living and dead were lying together in the same beds. 40 children had died in the previous week before a particular inspection. And the awful thing was that they were being buried in some of these workhouses within the grounds of the workhouses, very close to the water supply, to the wells. Those conditions persisted. And this is a thing that is very difficult for anyone to defend government policy. It wasn't just for a year. It wasn't a question like Hurricane Katrina, a one-off. This went on for year after year. And the major debts in the famine, where you're 50,000 a year, you're hundreds of thousands a year emigration, that period went on as late from 1846 to 1852, 6 years. And it was clearly following the policy of enforced evacuation, get them off the land, trying to make the holdings bigger, trying to make it fit for not the growing of potatoes and the, eating greens. They had various kind of weeds almost, but to make for what the British called high farming. At that time, England was the leading farming nation in Europe, and they were hopeful of bringing it up to their levels. But with the absentee landlords, lack of capital formation, lack of education, of course, that was quite hopeless. And the debts continued. The emigration was particularly horrific. You probably heard about the conditions in Boston, for example, when they got here, or in Liverpool or in New York, where the Gangs in New York film about Lord Lansdowne tenants all congregated there. And in the newspapers at the time, you'd find them described as the most filthy and ragged people, emigrants of all. In Canada, some of Lord Palmerston's tenants, who were forcibly emigrated, landed naked in the snows. And they were not emigrating people who could make a contribution to the new colonies or to the new world. It was widows, orphans, sick people, sickly people they were emigrating. And even when you had healthy people, the terrible thing, the terrible nature, the pressure of the people to get onto those, they were called coffin ships because the number of people who died on them. The coffin ships were in fact devised not for human transport, but for the transport of timber from North America to Europe. And they used them then to send them back with the human ballast. There was some money made on the return journey by taking people. And the conditions were awful. It gave rise to a saying that if you were to walk on the corpses of those who died on the passage, you could walk dry shod across the Atlantic. That's obviously an exaggeration, but it gives you an idea of the scale of the death. And other episodes, like you may have seen the film Sophie's Choice, where a Nazi officer gave Sophie the choice, which of her two children could she keep and which would she send to the gas chamber. And the Willis family, who left from Limerick, had to make that choice. a little boy fell ill with fever, typhus, just as they were going for the ship. And they had to leave him on the dock, because if they came aboard with typhus, they'd all be refused. They'd all die. But they all died anyway, or nearly all. The other four children died during the voyage and were thrown overboard. The father, John, died just before they arrived. And Mary, the mother, made it to Canada, where a kindly old Protestant clergyman helped her and discovered her story then and wrote it up. And so we now know about her fate. But the ordinary people in England didn't know as much about it as you'd imagine. There was a world opinion and there was condemnation over here, for example, about the way people were landing, and the New York authorities imposed penalties on ship owners and ship's captains to keep them out so they wouldn't be landing fever victims in New York. And they went down to Canada and walked back, many of them. They had no such restrictions in England. And, for example, during my research period, I was in Dumbarton in Scotland, and I was up the Clyde at a point where they could show you where here on the right-hand side, with no monument or anything, just folk memory to show you, was where the Scottish Highlanders left during the clearances. They were being cleared off the land also from the Highlands. But they went in pretty well-founded vessels to places like Nova Scotia, New Scotland, and they began a life there in fairly decent conditions, as decent as the standards of that time allowed. But here on the left, again without being marked, was where countless Irish came ashore from the packet that came from Belfast, shortest trip across the sea, and they just died, like in Gros Isle at the mouth of the St. Lawrence. They were too weak to come ashore, and they died and drowned in the shallows. Now, when all that was going on, you would imagine there'd been a great outcry, but particularly, well, Russell had a hand in it, but Woods and Trevelyan controlled, literally, the policy of the most important information outlet there was in Europe at the time. That was the Times of London. Now, I couldn't explain to you how important it was in terms of British public opinion. It'd be far more than amalgamating CNN, Fox, BBC, Al Jazeera, Channel 4, what you will. What the Times said was, it was called the Thunderer, and it really counted, and the policy of the Times was that of Woods and Trevelyan and the others in the cabinet, and they even wrote editorials for it. Amongst their editorials, well, maybe not theirs, but amongst the editorials that were printed, there were editorials which said things like, we welcome the famine. Famine was a blessing, that word was used. And they looked forward to a time when the Celt, this is echoing Trevelyan's anti-Celticism as much as anti-Irishism, we look forward to the time when the Celt ceases to be potato-phagy and becomes a carnivore. And with that would come habits of self-reliance, hard work, and generally a better species of humanity through eating meat. Sure, rubbish, but it was believed. And it was the sort of thing that was furthered because as a result of the Catholic emancipation and all the furore that sounded out, and the virulent strain of anti-Protestantism that's still, of anti-Catholicism, which at that time still existed in English society, particularly easy to foment by clergymen and so forth, it was easy to propagate the idea of this being providence. Providentialism is a great thing in those days. Providentialism was the Irish version or the English version of manifest destiny over here. It's clearly manifest destiny to exterminate the Seminoles and the Sioux, because then the white Anglo-Saxon settlers get the land. And so it was in Ireland. And providentialism was a tremendous theory and much favoured by these economists who circulated around the London Political Club and had a great deal of influence on political thinking. And Woods and Trevelyan and the others, they all used the Times, they're all politicians, they use leaks and so on. But the result of all their importunings and the manipulations were that one editorial, which I think pretty well sums up what they were at, said this. It was during 1848 when emigration was mushrooming, and they said, "A Celt will soon be as rare on the banks of the Shannon as the red man on the banks of Manhattan." So that was something devoutly to be wished. And so, even though English public opinion had initially been very sympathetic, there were very large donations made later on in the famine by those methods, by donor fatigue, by the fact that in desperation there had been a very ineffectual rising, the Young Islander Rising in 1848. All that played into the anti-camps version of what Irish Troubles stemmed from, and subscriptions in the second public opinion were nothing like the first. So it was quite easy for them to restrict charitable aid and to allow, quote, natural causes to take their effect. And remember, I've just described the interior, or semi-described the interior of a cabin. But if you tumble that cabin, and thousands like it, and put the grandmother, father, and wife, and the children out in an Irish January night or day, and hunt them from from that land, because they didn't want them around. They wanted the land without those tenants. If you hunt them out starving, without rain gear was unheard of, a week or two of natural causes will take care of matters. And so it happened. It wasn't just the shorthand debt toll that was usually given was a million dead and a million emigrated. In fact, modern scholarship has shown that statistic keeping was so bad and that families went so there was no one to record the deaths, and you also lost births which would have happened. There were averted births. It would be truer to say it was close to 2 million dead and a million emigrated, and a shock administered to the Irish political system from which we got what we now have, our population, which is dwindling. It's about 4 million and a million in the north, just under 6 million. Now, summing up from his perspective, Lord John Russell wrote later on in the 1868 or thereabouts to a friend, and this was his verdict on the famine and what it had achieved. He said, writing as if this had been a great success, he said, "The remedies," mark that word, "the remedies have been due partly to the divine providence and partly to human exertions. Many years ago, the Political Economy Club of London came, as I was told, to a resolution that the emigration of 2 million of the population of Ireland would be the best cure for her social evils. Famine and emigration have accomplished a task beyond the reach of legislation or government, and Providence has justly been afflicted us. Providence has justly afflicted us by the spectacle of the results of the entire dependence on potato cultivation and by the old fires of disaffection which had been ignited in the hearts of Irishmen and are now burning with such freshness on the banks of the Hudson and the Tomac." A woman called William Woodham Smith wrote a very fine book on the famine when it came out, and reviewing it, the then leading English historian, A.J.P. Taylor, said that British policy had made of all Ireland a Belsen, another concentration camp, a horrible concentration camp. That was then fresh in the memory of young people, young and old, and that is how he described Ireland. Now, of course, those concentration camps, Belsen, Auschwitz, Dachau, they were all used as instruments of a genocide. And that was his summing up. And I say also that it was genocide. And I'll just quote from you the UN Convention on Genocide. Now, whether one chooses to argue that you can't retrospectively apply the standards of today to what happened then, these words clearly describe what happened in Ireland between 1845 and 1852. This is what it says genocide means. Any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or part a national, ethical, racial or religious group as such. A. Killing members of the group. B. Causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. C. Deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about the physical destruction in whole, its physical destruction in whole or part. D. Imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. E. Forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. And that's the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, Article 2. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is what I submit accurately describes what happened in Ireland in the middle of the 19th century. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Irish historical writer Tim Pat Coogan titled The Famine Plot, England's Role in Ireland's Greatest Tragedy. Our lecture was presented by the Center for the Study of Europe at Boston University. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities Meg Tyler. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.